Without going into too much detail, but hopefully enough to give you a flavour of what the main issues are and where we're at. So on page 3 of the presentation, I've set out the main timelines, and on the top left corner, you can see the offsetting project, which is now finalised. That's the mandatory effective dates of the two pieces, which I'll talk about in a moment. And the other three projects are ones where, in each case, for the general hedge accounting, impairment, classification and measurement, you should see new documents in the near future. On general hedge accounting, the review draft or staff draft should be posted on the website in the next month or so. And on impairment and classification and measurement, we hope to have exposure drafts out on those two parts of the project, despite actually any formal decision on exposure drafts. I think if I was a betting woman, I'd say they'll both be exposure drafts, which should come out in the second half of 2012. Macro hedge accounting's not up there, not because I've forgotten about it, but it's a little bit more uncertain in terms of timing and what the next step is, but I will talk about that during the course of the presentation. So looking first at the completed parts of the financial instruments agenda, which unfortunately doesn't take very long. IFRS 9 effective date, the first easy one. In December, as Hans mentioned earlier, the board agreed to defer the mandatory effective date of IFRS 9, so the classification and measurement piece, from the 1st of January 2013, moving it back to the 1st of January 2015. As I think Hans also said, that was pretty unanimously supported, not least because people, you know, like putting off the evil day when they actually have to apply something, but also because the board had always said that because we were doing IFRS 9 in phases, we've got the classification and measurement piece, which we did first, impairment and then hedge accounting, we'd always said that we'd review the mandatory date because the objective of the board was to try and make sure all of the pieces would be mandatory at the same time. Given that we haven't finalised impairment or hedge accounting yet, clearly the 1st of January 2013 was becoming more problematic. People needed to start preparing their comparatives, if nothing else. And so the board decided that a more realistic date was the 1st of January 2015, when we hoped that all of the pieces of IFRS 9 would be available at the same time. Obviously, we'll need to reassess that as time goes by. The other thing we would have always hoped is that the mandatory effective date of an insurance standard might be aligned as well, so that could ultimately impact the mandatory date of IFRS 9 again. But for now, it's the 1st of January 2015, and people can still choose to early apply if they want to, which has always been the case. The other change, which on the surface looks small but was a very big deal for preparers, was comparative relief. In IFRS 9, we had always said that if you were a very early adopter, so if you adopted before the 1st of January 2012, you didn't need to restate your comparative financial statements for the effect of adopting IFRS 9. People told us that it would be very helpful on a permanent basis to provide that relief, and the board decided that that was appropriate, so that was part of this package we published in December, but we did say that if, as a result of not needing to restate comparatives, preparers do need to provide extra disclosures which help users understand the effect on the financial statements of having stopped applying IAS 39 and started applying IFRS 9. But they should be easier to apply than a full comparative restatement. The next completed project is offsetting, where we set out originally hoping to reach a position where we would have the same offsetting applying on the face of the balance sheet under both US GAAP and IFRS. Unfortunately, as is the problem when we've got two independent boards with strong views, and also, to be fair, two sets of constituents who are equally strong-minded and with different views, we didn't manage to come to a common position on offsetting. But what the boards decided to do, as a sort of second best, if you like, was to try and help users, which was our starting point, to try to make it easier for users of financial statements to understand the difference between the balance sheets of preparers under IFRS and US GAAP, particularly for financial institutions, and particularly for financial institutions with lots of derivatives, because that's where the really big differences in offsetting arise under US GAAP and under IFRS. Under US GAAP, as you probably know, there's an exception to the normal offsetting requirements that mean that you can choose to apply offsetting if you have in place master netting arrangements, and preparers typically do make that election under US GAAP. It makes a huge difference. The sorts of magnitudes of differences that are talked about is a difference in the size of a balance sheet of a big derivative using bank of around 30% between US GAAP and IFRS. So to try and help users in the absence of being able to get to the same place on the face of the balance sheet, in December we went out with the same disclosure requirements under both US GAAP and under IFRS that would be mandatory from the 1st of January 2013. And up on the slide you can see essentially what that does. We didn't say that you needed to show what your offsetting would be under IFRS and what your offsetting would be under US GAAP, because we thought that was going a step too far. It would mean that preparers would need to understand both sets of requirements in detail and also keep up with any changes in those requirements. So what the board's decided to do as the next best approach to do it without being so burdensome was to provide the set of disclosures which shows on the left-hand side what your gross amounts are outstanding before you apply any offsetting, and on the extreme right-hand side in column E, what your net amounts are, taking into account all sorts of mitigants for credit risk, so collateral arrangements and et cetera. So the net arrangements on the right-hand side and the gross arrangements on the left-hand side would be common whether you're an IFRS GAAP preparer or a US GAAP preparer. How you get from the first column to the last column then differs depending on whether you're a US GAAP or an IFRS GAAP preparer. In the middle, you'll see in column C, in the middle of the table, that's the amount that's actually on your balance sheet. So a US GAAP preparer, because they have more offsetting in their financial statements, will tend to have more items in column B, which show how they get from their gross amounts to their US GAAP balance sheet net amounts, whereas IFRS preparers will tend to have more amounts in column D, because, for example, looking at the most obvious case, if you've got master netting agreements, they don't typically qualify for offsetting under IFRS, but they would qualify to be in column D because they are a credit risk mitigant. And so you'll get from A to E in a different way, but users will have a more common understanding and also a more thorough understanding of offsetting and credit risk mitigant actions being undertaken by preparers. The other thing that the IASB did, and this is IFRS only, not US GAAP, as a result of the offsetting project, was to issue some clarifications to our offsetting guidance. Even though the background of the project was to try and get to a common solution under IFRS and under US GAAP, what we found out through the process was that there was quite a bit of inconsistent application of IFRS that we hadn't previously been, at least not so aware of. And the board decided that we should take the opportunity to tidy up the guidance in IFRS to ensure more, hopefully to ensure more consistent application. So at the same time as putting out the new disclosures, we added to the application guidance in IAS 32 to make it clear which circumstances qualify for offsetting under IAS 32, particularly the fact that the offsetting arrangements need to survive the bankruptcy both of the preparer and of their counterparty, and also to clarify which set-off or net settlement systems would qualify for offset under IAS 32. Because we got feedback before we even finalised these standards through our outreach process that this will be quite time-consuming for some preparers, the board decided that the mandatory application date for this set of changes would be the 1st of January 2014, so a year later than the disclosure requirements, to give people time to go through their contracts and make sure that they're applying these requirements properly. So those are the finished pieces, and now on to the active pieces of the project. And I'll talk first about the impairment phase of the project. As Hans said this morning, we've had a few false starts on impairment and it's taken us longer to get where we are than we had hoped. And that's been not least because of an attempt to try to reach a common solution with the FASB. If you look back at the history of the project, going back to 2009, 2010, the boards went out originally both proposing a move to an expected loss impairment model, but with very different proposals. So part of what's taken us so much time is to try and get the boards to a common place where they're comfortable with a common set of requirements that can be proposed for comment. We tried that last year when we published our supplementary document, but to be fair, that was really a compromise between the two boards, and it looked like a compromise between the two boards. And people came back to us and said, you know, you're having a laugh here. You think you, we don't really think that this is a common set of requirements. This is two different objectives that you've put in one document and told us it's a common outcome. And really, we think you should do better, and it's important that you do better. So on the basis of that feedback, we didn't actually go ahead and re-deliberate the supplementary document at all. In July last year, the two boards sat down and started to think about a new way of thinking about impairment that they could both accept. And the three-bucket model, as it's unfortunately come to be known as, is where we've landed up. And the three-bucket approach came from a very simple idea that some of the board advisors had. And it was the idea that if you have a loan that goes bad, it would have a fairly common life cycle in its decline. Usually when you lend somebody some money or you buy an asset, you do it with the expectation that that particular asset will pay in full. You don't lend money to people assuming they're not going to pay it back. So everything starts off being good, and you think good things about it. Ultimately, loans end up being bad, and you basically move into recovery mode, but along the way, what often happens is that you start to be a bit more concerned about a particular loan and start to reassess whether you really think it's going to pay in full. And what the boards decided they wanted to do was to try to develop an impairment model which essentially shows that a loan goes from being good to looking a bit more dubious to finally being bad. And it wanted to show that life cycle of a bad loan. And both boards agreed that it was definitely an expected loss, a forward-looking approach that we wanted to develop, and that we wanted the approach to be as responsive as possible to new information about credit quality. New information about a worsening loan should be reflected through this life cycle, the three-bucket approach, but also by updating your expected loss assumptions, taking into account all new information that's available to you. And so this has led to this so-called three-bucket approach, where in bucket one, we have our good loans, and in bucket two and three, we have the loans that we no longer consider to be good. And what the boards decided early on was that for the loans that you no longer think are good, so for buckets two and three, you should reflect an allowance balance equal to the whole of life expected loss for those loans. It should be, you know, no questions asked. Just book the whole of life expected loss as an allowance for those loans. But for bucket one, these include new loans that you've just issued on market terms. And the boards both agreed that it wasn't really appropriate to make people establish an allowance on day one for the full lifetime loss on a loan when you've just priced it at market. And so the boards decided that bucket one should be less than a lifetime loss. And in December, the boards agreed jointly that it should be a 12-month expected loss objective for bucket one. When we say 12-month, we mean the whole of life loss on those loans that you expect could go bad in the next 12 months. So that's bucket one. The boards decided that you should move out of bucket one, so out of this partial loss allowance world into a full lifetime allowance world, when two things happen. Firstly, where your loan has deteriorated from what you originally expected when you first put it on your books. So there has to be a deterioration, so things don't start in bucket two or three. And in addition, as a result of the deterioration, you've ended up with a loan where the likelihood of default is such that it's reasonably possible that all of the contractual cash flows won't be collected. So you need a deterioration, and it needs to get to a particular level of credit risk before you move to buckets two or three. The reason for that twofold test is also twofold. Firstly, the first part of the test, the insignificant deterioration, was because the boards decided it wasn't appropriate to start any loan off in bucket one, with one small exception, which I'll discuss later, but for simplification, everything starts in bucket one. So if I lend money to somebody that's of a weaker credit quality, a non-investment grade credit, even though it's a weaker credit quality, because I price it on market terms, it still starts in bucket one, its 12-month allowance will be higher than a loan to a AAA, but it still starts in bucket one. So the first principle here for a transfer, make sure that happens, because nothing moves out of bucket one until there's been a more than insignificant deterioration. So it's a deterioration concept. The boards were very strong that that's what they want the model to capture. However, during the whole impairment project and in this phase as well, we've been in a lot of communication with financial institutions, and they've told us that anything that we can do to make it easier for them to apply this model would be helpful. And one thing they've told us is that it would be useful if the model mapped as closely as possible to their credit risk management systems. And that's the reason for the second test. The banks know when their loans have reached a particular credit quality. They know from their internal grading systems that when the probability of default has reached a particular level, and that's why we have the second test. And what that means is that if you routinely originate loans that are of a very high credit quality, if loans of that type are now at a poor credit quality, you know by definition that the first test has been met. So it reduces some of the tracking concerns that the banks have, but still using a deterioration concept. Now, most of what the boards have talked about in the last few months has been to talk about when things should be moved to a whole of life allowance bucket. So it's been a very much a deterioration focus. But at this February meeting, the board will talk about what you do if something actually improves. So what happens if you had a good loan, it went bad, and now it looks like it's good again? Could it move back to bucket one, and when? And the staff are going to recommend to the board that it should be a symmetrical model, that there's information content for people that a loan's become good again, and that should be reflected in a transfer back to bucket one. Basically, the recommendation is that if these criteria for deterioration are no longer met, then it's appropriate to start back in bucket one again, and that's what will be discussed at the February meeting. Now, the whole model is founded upon assessing lifetime losses. It's based on, in bucket one, you only need to measure the lifetime losses on things that you think will go bad in the next 12 months, but the whole model is founded on a lifetime loss assessment, and what it's looking at is the expectations of collections of cash flows. To try and assist people in applying the model and also to make sure that we have as much consistency in application as is possible within a model which is inherently judgmental because it's based on expectations, the board has agreed to a set of indicators that can be used to guide people to determine when a transfer out of bucket one is appropriate. One point that I didn't mention when I was on the bucket 1, 2, 3 page, which I should have, is the unit of evaluation. When the boards were originally developing the model, they were distinguishing between buckets 1, 2 and 3 based on credit quality. So everything in bucket 1 was good, everything in bucket 3 was bad, and everything in bucket 2 was uncertain, if you like. This was where the good, bad and ugly came from that Hans mentioned this morning. Actually, in December, the board decided to modify that slightly. The boards both decided that the difference between bucket 2 and bucket 3 should not be the credit quality of things in bucket 2 and bucket 3. Both are lifetime losses that are being measured. Both have the same measurement objective. And they decided that really the distinction between bucket 2 and bucket 3 should be based on whether the assessment of credit quality is being made on an individual loan basis, which would be bucket 3, or whether it would be made on a collective basis, which would be bucket 2. So the difference between bucket 2 and 3 now is depending on whether you're looking at groups of loans or individual loans. We're not dictating which of those is required. Generally, if you want to make an assessment on an individual basis, that's allowed. That gives you more granular information. But you can group things together as long as they have shared risk characteristics. We don't want people grouping together, you know, retail mortgages with loans to power plants. But within reason, if things have shared risk characteristics, so for example, all of your mortgages to a particular jurisdiction or town or whatever level of granularity you want to use, that could be looked at as a portfolio and that could form the basis for a bucket 2 calculation. I said there was one exception to starting off in bucket one, and it's an exception that's supposed to be narrow, but it can be an important one. And that's situations where somebody actually buys a loan that's already a bad loan. We don't think people originate bad loans, but we do know people buy bad loans. Can be because they actually are in the business of buying bad loans and then trying to do the best they can with them, and they may be better at that than the market as a whole. Or it could just be because you're doing a business combination or an acquisition, and as part of the whole block of loans or business that you're buying, there's some bad loans in there that you need to deal with. And in those cases, the board is concerned that recognising interest based on the contractual interest rate isn't really appropriate if you know there's no chance that that contractual interest is going to be recovered. It doesn't produce useful information. So the board decided that in this case, the interest should be calculated based on your initial loss expectations. So it's different to the whole rest of the model. And because you've taken into account your initial loss estimates when you've worked out your effective interest rate to calculate your interest, you can't establish an allowance on day one because you'd be counting those same losses twice. So for these loans, they come in with an adjusted effective interest rate and no initial allowance balance. Because they're coming in and they're already bad loans, the board's decided that from a practical perspective, it makes sense just to put them straight into bucket two or bucket three, depending on whether you're looking at them as a portfolio or on an individual basis. And the reason we did that was purely a practical one. If you've bought a bad loan, chances are if it deteriorates at all, it's going straight to bucket two or bucket three anyway, so why not just put it in there and make everybody's lives a little bit easier? And the board decided on that. Where we came a little bit unstuck, though, in a sort of convergence aspect, was on one point of this. Both boards agree that that's the treatment, and both boards agree that's what should happen if you purchase a bad loan. But at the moment, we're having a bit of a difference in terms of what we think the bad loan should be. Now, under IFRS today, we already have this criteria. Well, we already have the requirement to calculate an interest rate based on loss estimates if you buy a loan that's credit impaired. And we really want to keep the population to that. It's quite tricky operationally to do this. It's very similar, actually, to our ISB original ED, which everybody told us they couldn't apply. So we want to try and use this as little as possible. So our proposal is that a bad loan would be one, essentially, that has incurred losses when you buy it, and you've bought it at a deep discount because of those incurred losses. The FASB have asked their staff to go away and consider whether, in fact, a bad loan for these purposes should be a loan that's at a bucket two credit quality, which would be a broader spectrum. We've said we don't want to investigate that because of our concerns about operationality, given the feedback we had on our original ED. The FASB may get there ultimately, but they're doing a bit more work thinking about the scope of this decision in the meantime. And that, I think, is all I'm going to say on impairment. In terms of next steps, we've still got some more decisions to make. As I said at the February meeting, we're going to talk about the symmetry of the model, how it should deal with improvements in credit quality. We've focused mainly on deterioration so far. The other important topic that we'll discuss in February is how the model should apply to trade receivables. We've had a lot of feedback saying that the model's quite complicated for people who aren't really in the business of lending money. They're in the business of selling widgets, and their receivables are secondary to their main business. They ask whether they need to have the same level of complexity. The staff's recommendation is that we do apply an expected loss model to trade receivables, but that it's applied on a more simple basis. So for short-term trade receivables, things would go directly into bucket two. You'd always calculate a lifetime expected loss because it's less than 12 months anyway. There's really no difference in the measurement between bucket one and bucket two. So why make people track the loans? And so we recommend an expected loss model, but on a simplified basis for short-term trade receivables. We've also got another couple of topics to discuss. One is off-balance sheet items such as loan commitments and financial guarantee contracts. People have told us they use the same credit risk management system, so they'd like us to have similar concepts, but we need to work out the detail on that. We need to work out what to do with restructured loans. And last but not least, we need to look at what disclosures should be required given the overall package that we've come up with. The staff's plan at the moment, if everything goes smoothly, is that these discussions should be finished by June, and that would enable us to come out with our next document for public comment in the second half, but hopefully in the earlier rather than the later part of the second half this year. So that's impairment. I'll talk briefly now about classification and measurement. The first phase of IFRS 9 that we thought was finished, but unfortunately it's not. And the limited modifications to IFRS 9. Now Hans talked about this briefly this morning, but I'll give you a little bit more colour on why and what, because I know many are wondering what exactly limited modifications mean. So last, I think, November, the board, the ISB, decided that it was appropriate to reconsider the first part of IFRS 9. And that followed quite a long period of time where we said that it was finished and we'd done a great job and we weren't going to look at it again. So this was quite a big decision for the board to make. But I think it was a very responsive decision, very responsive to feedback we've had from people. And hopefully, based on the way that we want to approach it, it should minimise the disadvantages for those who have already incorporated IFRS 9 into their accounting requirements. And what the board decided was that IFRS 9 classification and measurement is fundamentally sound. Based on all of the discussions that we've had, and we've had a lot of discussions with preparers who have either started to apply IFRS 9 or those who have spent a lot of time and money getting ready to apply IFRS 9, it's fundamentally sound, and people think it's an improvement on IAS 39. It's got more structure around how things get classified, and people like the concepts in there of the notions of principal and interest and business model being used as a foundation for the classification of financial instruments. But we are aware of some application issues with IFRS 9, so those are something that we'll ask the board to look at. We also have always said that we would look at IFRS 9 and see how well it dovetailed with the insurance contracts project decisions. We now have enough decisions on the insurance contracts project to know that it could be helpful to look at the measurement of financial assets as a way to deal with some of the volatility concerns people have with the insurance project. So we felt that was timely. And last but not least, we thought that we should look at whether there were ways that we could try to reduce differences with the FASB model. Now that their model is largely developed, it's stable enough for us to finally to compare what IFRS 9 has got in it and what the FASB model has in it. And it's really the first point in time now that their model is developed enough for us to be able to make that assessment. So while we always said that it was finished, we always did say that we were mindful of... the interaction with those other projects and particularly convergence. And so the time was right, if you like, to look at IFRS 9. But the board was very much aware that people have spent a lot of money, as I said, on getting ready for IFRS 9, and some are already actually using it. So it's not as though we can come up with a clean sheet of paper and come up with a new classification and measurement model, nor do we want to, because we liked the foundations of IFRS 9 already. The board decided that there's really three main areas that we want to consider in IFRS 9. And it probably makes sense to comment on the FASB model while I'm on this slide, in fact. IFRS 9, just to recap, has got two categories for classifying financial assets, essentially: amortized cost and fair value through profit or loss. And IFRS 9 tells you whether or not you're eligible for amortized cost or whether you need to apply fair value based on what the contractual cash flow characteristics of your assets are and what your business model is. Essentially, if you've got an instrument that is a vanilla debt instrument, it can be eligible for amortized cost measurement dependent on what your business model is. IFRS 9 also had another important change, was that in order to simplify the accounting for financial instruments, it eliminated bifurcation for financial assets. So that, in a nutshell, is IFRS 9. Originally, the FASB went out with a proposal that would have really required fair value measurement for all financial instruments. Since then, based on the feedback that they've received, they've changed to a mixed measurement model. So like IFRS 9, a model where some things are at amortised cost and some things are at fair value. However, there's a couple of differences between our two models. The good thing is that their model also relies on what the cash flow characteristics of an asset are and what the business model is to decide how assets should be classified. So that's, again, consistent with IFRS 9. But the way that they determine contractual cash flow characteristics is different. They still allow bifurcation for financial assets and financial liabilities based on their existing criteria. And also they have a third business model which requires some debt instruments to be measured at fair value through OCI. And in particular, their model would result in most debt securities, so most listed debt instruments being measured at fair value through OCI, whereas under IFRS 9, as long as it was a vanilla debt instrument and you held it to collect its contractual cash flows, you'd be eligible for amortised cost. So that's one important difference between the two models. So looking at those, you can see that the things that our boards decided to focus on fit in very well with trying to focus on differences with the FASB model. Firstly, deciding what a vanilla debt instrument is the first thing, essentially. Contractual cash flow characteristics. What is a vanilla debt instrument that should be eligible for something other than fair value through P&L? And that's something we'll discuss jointly with the FASB. Secondly, we'll reconsider whether there should be bifurcation of financial assets, not least because of the decision by the FASB not to eliminate bifurcation for financial assets. And if we do have bifurcation, what should the basis of the bifurcation be? And thirdly, because of the insurance contracts project and also because the FASB model includes a third category, we'll look at whether it would be appropriate for us to introduce a third category for debt instruments that would be measured at fair value, but through OCI, and when debt instruments would qualify for that. Would it be because they're liquid securities, or would it be because of the way that you manage those instruments? In January, the boards made a formal decision to work together to try to reduce the differences between our two models, and you'll see the beginnings of those discussions this month in February. We'll discuss whether the contractual cash flow characteristics that are used to decide whether something could be eligible for a category other than fair value through P&L, so amortised cost or fair value through OCI, whether we can come to a common place on that. And what the staff will be recommending will be that both boards use the notion of principal and interest along the lines of what's in IFRS 9 today. So the recommendation of the staff is to move toward a model very similar to IFRS 9 as a basis for deciding what a vanilla debt instrument is. In doing that, we'll try to discuss some of the application issues we're aware of in IFRS 9 today. But if the boards adopt that recommendation, that would be quite a small change to IFRS 9. Following that first discussion, the plan from the staff at the moment is that in March, we'll discuss the business models that we have in IFRS 9, the business models that we have in the FASB's tentative model, and discuss how we might be able to bring our business models closer together and whether the IASB should adopt three business models like the FASB. And then in April, we'll discuss whether there should be bifurcation for financial assets and financial liabilities. So we hope to have quite a targeted and short-term project to focus on the key differences between the boards. And I think the boards have been relatively realistic in their expectations, particularly because the IASB has already published IFRS 9. We can't really go out with a radically different document to IFRS 9. What the boards are going to try and do is to try and reach decisions that are as close as possible, and then we would publish separate EDs that would reflect the common decisions. So the words may be different, but the objective would be as far as possible to get to similar outcomes. And the plan would be to try to publish exposure documents reflecting those decisions in the second half of the year. Now, hedge accounting, I'm not going to go into too much detail. I don't think it really works in a big forum, and I could spend all day talking about the details of hedge accounting, but I won't do that to you. So talking big picture, General hedge accounting. The IASB finished their deliberations on general hedge accounting in September last year and agreed at that time that rather than going straight to the final IFRS, we would introduce an interim step of putting the near final version of that document on our website for a 90-day period, not formally soliciting comment, but obviously we would listen if people have issues with the document. And really the 90-day period has a twofold purpose. One is to give our constituents time to look at the words to make sure that they are clear and we've addressed some of the wording issues that were raised with our exposure draft. The other reason for the 90-day hiatus, if you like, was really to give the FASB time to catch up, to decide whether or not they want to pursue something more like our hedge accounting proposals or theirs. They went out with their own hedge accounting proposals that were much less ambitious than ours, but they also issued a wraparound where they asked their constituents for feedback on our document. So they have comments on both documents to consider, and they are yet to decide what their next steps are. Big picture, what our general hedge accounting document seeks to do is to improve the decision usefulness of information about hedging activities in the financial statements. Today, users can't understand what on earth hedge accounting is all about. It's very technical, big barriers to entry in terms of understanding it. We're trying to improve that in two ways. One's by making hedge accounting apply in a manner that's more consistent with risk management activities. And secondly, by enhancing the disclosures generally around risk management activities when people have applied hedge accounting. So those are the two main themes in the general hedge accounting document. We do that by trying to improve the effectiveness testing so it's more aligned with economic concepts that people use to decide whether their hedges are good hedges or not. And one other important change is by allowing people who hedge non-financial risks to reflect the fact that they're only hedging particular risks in their non-financial exposures rather than entire financial exposures and non-financial exposures. In terms of the target timeline there, the current plan would be that we hope to put that document on our website, hopefully by the end of March, for a 90-day period, and then finalise the IFRS in the second half of 2012, obviously always subject to what the FASB decide to do. Macro hedge accounting is even more technical and, frankly, intimidating, so I'm certainly not going to go into detail on that. And I'll talk more generally here about what the plan is, or what the suggestions of the staff are to the board at the moment on macro hedge accounting. Since the middle of last year, the staff have organised a lot of education for the board in small group meetings and in public sessions where we've really had a range of financial institutions in particular come in and talk to the board about how they manage risk on a portfolio basis. And the purpose of that has been to give the board a solid foundation to understand what the risk management activities are that we're actually trying to account for. And believe me, it's pretty scary stuff. It's in the sense that it's very, very technical and very, very mathematical. And it's taking a long time for us to get comfortable that we've got a solid foundation for decision making. So that's one aspect. The second aspect is what we're trying to do is not just tweak the general hedge accounting requirements to try and sort of shoehorn portfolio hedge accounting into the general model. What we're actually trying to do is take a step back, look at the risk management we're trying to deal with, and work out a way that we can provide information that's really going to be helpful to users of financial statements. Now, the actual accounting idea that we're developing there isn't a very sophisticated idea at all. All we're saying, asking the board to consider, is whether it would be appropriate to take financial instruments that are usually measured at amortized cost and to remeasure them for the risks that are being hedged. That's all it's about. Everybody thinks that we're doing something really dramatic, but in a nutshell, that's all we're investigating. The tricky bit, though, is working out how you measure the change because of that risk component, and that's what takes all of the time and the lengthy papers. But the model is a very different model. It's different to what's in 39 today. It's different to what's applied in other gaps. And we as staff are increasingly seeing the benefits of actually going to a discussion paper next rather than an exposure draft. So we get the benefit of, to use I think Paul's words this morning, broad-based thoughtful consideration on a global scale to feed into that process to make sure that we've got it right, that it does provide useful information for users and that preparers actually think that it better reflects their risk management activities, so that we've got the balance between those two things right. We think a discussion paper that gives us more thorough feedback would be a better basis for us then to re-deliberate and then to come out with some more concrete proposals. Obviously, that has implications for IFRS 9, because up until now we've always talked about an exposure draft for macro hedge accounting in the near term with a view to then having a complete IFRS 9, including macro for hedge accounting. What I think we're thinking at the moment we should explore would be rather finalising IFRS 9 to include classification and measurement, impairment and general hedge accounting, keeping IAS 39 intact as it is today for portfolio hedge accounting, so people's macro hedge accounting practices can stay in place as they are for now, and then once we've finalised the full review of macro hedge accounting, then adding that into IFRS 9. So trying to now change our focus to consider IFRS 9 as being complete with macro hedge accounting in 39, and then to more slowly and fully, in a more fully considered way, then incorporate macro hedge accounting into that IFRS 9 model. Now, the board hasn't made a full decision on that yet, but that's a staff recommendation to the board that we will consider at some point in time. So in terms of timing, that would mean that the next step for macro hedge accounting would be a discussion paper rather than an exposure draft. And in terms of timing, the plan would be that that discussion paper would be published sometime later in 2012.
Well, you've covered a lot of territory in a relatively brief time. Questions? Comments? Yes, Shizong.
Yes. I would like to ask a question concerning the impairment or trade receivable. Just now you mentioned that the board might consider to use a simplified expected loss model for trade receivable. But I think it's very difficult for business enterprises, especially business enterprises in a developing economy, to apply the so-called simplified expected loss model, because they don't have necessary data and model to determine the expected loss in the coming future. So my question is that, is it possible for the business enterprises to retain the incurred loss model? Because my understanding is that the switch from the incurred loss model to expected loss model is to reduce procyclical effect. But procyclical effect related mainly to financial institution. It has nothing to do with business enterprises. So is it possible, you know, to remain the current practice of the incurred loss model for trade receivable?
Ian told me off on this on Friday, so hopefully, Ian, you'll be happy with my response. But I think there's a twofold thing here. One is how the model would apply to trade receivables, in the sense, are we going to make you track through bucket one, bucket two, bucket three? And the staff recommendation is not to make people do that, at least for short-term trade receivables. So I think that's the first simplification. But the second question, the bigger question I think you're asking, is whether it would be enough just to keep an incurred loss model rather than an expected loss model. Now, on that, I think that our preference is that the model takes into account information that includes what you think will happen in the future based on information you have available today. But where I think we may be able to help and where we should help people is by clarifying exactly what that means. And that doesn't mean looking at probability-weighted cash flows and all of these things. It could be looking at loss matrices that corporates have used already in national GAAPs previously to come up with general provisioning-type concepts. And I actually think if we're clear what we mean when we talk about what our expectations are for the expected loss calculations for people, we might be able to demystify it and make it a lot less scary than what it sounds like in the first instance. I think a lot of what we're talking about is probably what a lot of people liked to do in their national GAAPs previously. It's probably what people think about when they manage their credit risk and their trade receivables today. I doubt that people blindly look at what's happening today and don't think about what's going to happen going forward. But I think the key point for us is going to be giving people comfort that we're not asking for something that's ridiculously complex and completely disconnected from their normal risk management activities. And I think that's our challenge, to give people comfort on that front.
Francois?
Is that okay, Ian?
Sorry, Francois.
Thank you, Paul. Just a few comments and maybe one or two recommendations. First of all, to start with a very positive note, and thank you, Sue, for the clarity of your presentation. You make things look simple. And I would like also to welcome the decision made by the ISB and with the FASB to at last reconsider classification and measurement in view of improving IFRS 9 and solving issues and also considering the insurance project altogether. This fits, in fact, in the recommendations that we've been repeating, in fact, quite a few times for some while. So we're very happy with those decisions. That said, I mean, as you know, our recommendation is to always try for the highest quality possible. So that, and if we support the ISB in deciding that the reconsideration of IFRS 9 would be narrowly defined, I think that's also something that we would support. We would nevertheless wish that the ISB, in making these decisions, would not move away from having a fully principle-based approach, and that in the final decisions, we all can see that the characteristics of the instrument and the business model together have been the determinant factors in the classification, the measurement, and the presentation adopted. Then maybe, I mean, given the importance of this project and also the fact that we all around the globe have worked very much and have studied, analyzed, and considered many of these issues, maybe that's the time to test the collaborative effort with regional groups together with the ISB, FASB before coming to NED. To really test how welcome these final changes can be. And my last point would be, in fact, a question. Now that, you know, this ISB and FASB are working back together, if the outcome is really coming to similar outcomes, I think it would be a missed opportunity for the FASB not to propose IFRS 9 on the basis of the modified exposure, because even when you have a standard which is similar, when you want to move to something which is, there is always a cost, there are always small adjustments, and probably the US could be, in fact, not have to incur those if the decision is positive. Thank you.
Thanks, Francois. Bruce, I think you're next up.
Thanks. Firstly, I'd also just like to echo that and say that where we've held meetings with especially the corporate clients of ours, the IFRS 9 has actually been very well received. I mean, I'll be honest with you, from our point of view, trying to explain to somebody how something held to maturity, had to be held to maturity, yet available for sale, didn't have to be for sale, it's got a bit tiring. So it's great that we can now get to a stage of that. The one concern that's been raised by a lot of people we work with is that the whole impairment model, a lot of it has been very much around the banking sector. So there's been a lot of input from the banking sector, a lot of input from financial institutions. And I guess the concern has been that are the kind of corporates, the multinational corporates, but those without the very complex treasuries, is this model going to work for them? And I guess the question I wanted to ask was, how much has this been tried and tested with the guys outside the banking sector? And what has their response been to the new proposed model that you've got?
We have done some initial outreach with some of the larger corporates who are more engaged in the process. I think the devil's going to be in the detail in terms of the point I made earlier in terms of what do we actually mean when we talk about expected losses. I think that the corporates and also smaller banks are both concerned that we are going to allow simplifications that are actually reasonable for them to apply.
I think that the corporates will be particularly receptive to us not requiring them to track from bucket one to bucket two to bucket three, because they just don't think that way. So I'm hopeful that that simplification should help. But I think that the bit we haven't debated yet, which is, as I say, important not just for them but also for the small banks, is making sure that it's clear that what we're requiring in terms of measurement is actually reasonable.
Just to follow up on that, because so much of what I've seen on this topic has made repeated mentions of financial institutions, and banks in particular, and almost no mention of anyone else. And it creates a huge communications problem. Experience is that people tend not to pay attention to things that they think are aimed at others, but come to life when the gun is finally pointed their way. So whatever can be done now to sort of broaden the language, and I'm sure that's the intention. Someone said earlier, the outreach efforts have been exceptional and very well received, but the sooner I think we start to demonstrate that sensitivity to the non-financial sector, coming back to the point about receivables, to demonstrate that those issues are being factored into the debate and not sort of an afterthought that says, oh, this has all been worked out in the context of the financial sector and perhaps not sufficient thought given to the non-financials. Sylvie, sorry, and then Vincent, and then Benoit, I think is the...
Thank you. Thank you, Sue, for the very comprehensive presentation. My question relates to impairment. I'm still trying to figure out what makes the difference between this current proposal and the incurred loss system, and in that respect, I have two questions. Why did you choose the 12 months for the first bucket? And the second question is that I understood that even if you have the dual test to move from bucket one to bucket two, you don't have trigger event. So it's much more related to judgment, I would say.
On the 12 months, the starting point for the 12 months was an agreement by the boards that they didn't want to book a full lifetime loss for the first bucket, so it needed to be something less than that. And the genesis for the 12 months was really an attempt to try and, in a simplified way, replicate some of the yield adjustment effects that we had in the ISB's original ED, but in a very simplified way. That was where part of the thinking came from. And also, I think, two other reasons for the 12 months, both of which were simplification-based, but vary slightly by jurisdiction. From the FASB's perspective, as far as I'm aware, they want as far as possible to try and use some of the mechanics already used by the banks in particular to look at 12-month loss rate type statistics and build on that thinking for bucket one. From a more international perspective, we were hoping that by using a 12-month cut in bucket one for those banks who already apply your Basel requirements with a 12-month outlook, they could use some of the statistics and information they already use for those purposes. They'd have to modify them, but it gave them a starting position that also provided some simplification. So that was the reason for the 12 months. In terms of the comparison with the incurred loss model, well, I guess firstly, in an incurred loss model, you typically wouldn't have this 12-month allowance for all of these things in bucket one. There's some exceptions depending on how people apply IBNR in different jurisdictions, but as a general rule. And the second thing that we're trying to ensure in terms of making it more forward-looking than the incurred loss model is that the information that you use to decide whether something moves from out of bucket one to either bucket two or bucket three includes forward-looking information, whereas today you can't use forward-looking information to determine your incurred losses. So even to the extent that we consider indicators to decide whether things should move from bucket one to bucket two or three, they're more forward-looking than today. Also, when you're in bucket one, bucket two, or bucket three, even if you stay in the same bucket, you need to update your loss allowance balances for changes in expectations over time, whereas today allowance balances need to be based on information that's currently available, current incurred losses. So the actual information set you use for the calculations is also more forward-looking. So we're trying to improve it over incurred loss with a combination of including the bucket one, criteria that move you from bucket one and the information that you use to actually make the allowance balances, which is more forward-looking than the loss information you establish for allowances today. We'll see what people's reaction is.
Another point, Sylvie seemed to imply, isn't this too judgmental? It is judgmental. Expected loss is judgmental. There's no other way.
Vincent.
Thanks. In the comments on the transition date deferral, you've highlighted two objectives, the first being to enable the process of convergence, and you also talked about trying to address the interdependent nature of the three main building blocks. And I think the comment that can be made is that there seems to be great progress, at least on two of these blocks, that's the classification and measurement and the impairments. However, from the presentation, what's less clear is whether there exists a mutually acceptable pathway to addressing hedge accounting. Both boards seem to be on different pathways. The FASB is taking, at least had proposed, a very limited approach to the recognition and measurement requirements relative to the approach that you've proposed. And there's some attempt to try and expose your model within the US. However, as you mentioned, there seems to be an imperative for them to catch up. And then this raises the question as to whether this is going to be a feasible path from their standpoint, and whether this is going to impact on convergence. And then, given the interdependent nature of these three building blocks, will IFRS 9 end up within the timeframes that have been proposed, will we actually come to a point of view where we can meaningfully have a situation where all the three building blocks of IFRS 9 are acceptable from a US and international standpoint?
I wasn't rushing to answer that one. obviously, the ideal would be if we had all of the three pieces converged. It would be what we would all like. But I think the feedback that we've had from people is, while they'd like us to have all of the aspects converged, the one where they, you know, everybody says you have to come to the same place as impairment, that's the one that everybody's most focused on us getting to the same place, for the simple reason that we can't ask people to run two different impairment systems and then try to reconcile between the outcomes of both. So that's the one where we really have to have convergence. Classification and measurement is also important, and I'm relatively optimistic based my own personal take based on discussions we've had in small group settings so far, that we will be able to reduce the differences in the model. So I think on classification and measurement, we're in pretty good shape as well. Hedge accounting is harder, not least because of the timelines, because the boards originally did discuss hedge accounting on a joint basis, and the FASB decided to disengage from our process because of timing issues at the time. So it was a conscious decision relatively early on. And while I think it would be obviously great if we could get to a common solution, I think realistically that will be quite challenging in the near term. The good thing is, if we're going to have one piece of the puzzle that's not aligned, hedge accounting is probably the one where it's easiest for it not to be aligned, in the sense that hedge accounting is voluntary anyway. So it's not as fundamental a component of the model. So that would be the only reaction I could give to you, because at some point in time we need to finalise our part of the project, and I think the FASB are sounding more like they're going to not look at hedge accounting at all until the other two pieces of the puzzle are finished. And on our other hand, we have a timing issue, because a number of our constituents, particularly the corporates, are very keen that, you know, we have hedge accounting finished by June if they had their way. So we've got a few competing interests there to try and manage.
I see two cards remaining. Benoit first.
Thank you. My problem is that, as somebody said, the business model which was issued in IFRS 9 was something simple, it was clear, and it was, as it was said, well received. I don't understand why actually we want to complicate things with a sort of third business model if the only issue is to include debt aspects and OCI. I think OCI was analyzed how it could be treated in the business model of IFRS 9. So I'm afraid that we will introduce more complications than what G20 asked us to do insofar as the financial instruments are concerned. My second aspect is we're finishing the convergence efforts as it was put in the slide with a separate exposure drafts. I don't know, for difficult problems like this one, in the past we have seen that when we have a joint exposure draft, many issues are already settled when we are writing them. While when we have two separate exposure drafts, it's also two separate bundles of problems which will be difficult to solve. So can I have some clarification, please? Thank you.
I'm not sure. Do you want to respond to that or just take it as noted? Panagiotis?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. From the perspective of the European Central Bank, a few comments. First, we strongly support the work of the IASB and take note of the improvement and the progress being made. On some issues of importance to us, first on the issue of IFRS 9, we take note of the need for limited modifications, which we broadly agree, and also would like to reiterate our support to the mixed measurement model, and especially for the use of fair value measurement. This is also something we are pursuing vis-a-vis the convergence with the US accounting standards, that we think that fair value measurement should only be required if it provides useful information. So in general, as a general issue. The second concerns the offsetting. We agree that common offsetting disclosures is an improvement, but certainly do not resolve the continuing divergence, and also the fact that there are differences, especially between the US GAAP and the IFRS, which severely hamper the comparability of financial statements. On impairment, as other mentioned, that I fully agree with the chairman, there is an issue of judgment there. For us, it's important also to avoid undue cliff effects from financial stability point of view when you have a massive move from one bucket to the other two. And last but not least, the macro hedge. I fully agree with the chairman also on the need for communicating. This is a general issue, but is also of particular importance for the banking sector, and I wanted to reiterate this. Thank you.
We'll do Fumio, and then we'll give last question or comment to Andrew. So.
Me? Oh, thank you. Yeah, I have the, one comment about the effective date, January 2015. You said, as you may know, the Japan has three accounting standards, Japanese standard, US GAAP, and IFRS. And most of the company using the apply the Japanese standard, but the main leading company also using the US GAAP. So my question is, if the mandatory effective date is January 2015, the still if US GAAP or FASB doesn't apply this IFRS 9 the, by 2015, that we may have the overburden of to make the two kinds of the financial statement, as you said, that don't necessarily to reconcile the IFRS and the US GAAP, but that means the, we are required to make two kinds of the financial statement. This is the still overburden to us. So I appreciate if you try to still try to effort the to converge, US GAAP and IFRS. This is not only the financial instrument, but also the total general accounting rules. That's my comment. Thank you.
Thank you.
Of course, the best is simply to adopt IFRS for Japan. Then you go. Then you go from 3 to 2.
Andrew.
Thank you. Just a couple of points, maybe picking up on one or two that have been made. On the converged solution part, I, like others, wouldn't want to see IFRS 9 polluted too much with additional complexity. But looking at the overall picture, we'd rather go there at least a little way to get full convergence with US GAAP than to have something that even had differences around the edges. And so we would certainly encourage the board to work towards a fully converged solution as far as possible, particularly to avoid arbitrage risk. And we saw that very sharply towards the end of 2008 when we had the reclassification amendment to IS 39. One thing I'd be interested in, if anyone feels that they can answer it, is whether you have a feel for the extent of the FASB's commitment in that direction as well, and whether they're seeking to head to a fully converged solution too. I think in that regard, to have a single exposure draft from both boards would probably be an advantage, because at least everyone's then working from the same document. On the question of impairment and trade receivables, it seems to me that a simplified version of the three-bucket approach, so you get a two-bucket approach instead, may well be heading towards something that would be operational. We've been involved, as some of those from the ISB may know, in a little bit of a limited outreach with the staff. And so it may well be something where, with some simplifications, we can get there. And some of the points that people have made about corporates looking to their previous GAAP, where they perhaps had a slightly softer approach to provisioning than a full hard incurred loss model, might be useful. Thank you.
All right. Well, a number of important points have been raised. We're a little overdue in terms of breaking for lunch. Sue, any final comments before we close up? Or you?
Just Andrew asked how confident we were that the FASB were. I think I'm confident that we'll reduce the differences. I'm not sure. I don't think we'll get completely converged, but I think we'll get closer.
And I sense many members supporting that notion of eliminating as many of the differences as possible. On the other hand, we need this thing finished within a reasonable time frame. So there's your dilemma, Hans. would remind you, please, we're going to have a group photograph. The quicker we get it done, the sooner you get to lunch. I would ask you, regardless of how long it takes, to be back here at 1:30. Thank you.